Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to another Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. Hope you enjoyed yesterday's Arscast Extra. James is back from his holidays. Misfortune befell him on his holidays. I'm sure that's no surprise to you. Make sure you listen to that if you haven't already. But I did promise we'd have an Arscast today if I could get something arranged. And thankfully, I did get that thing arranged. And that was to talk to the BBC's David Ornstein, who I'm sure many of you follow on Twitter and see as a very reliable source of Arsenal news, particularly during the transfer windows. So we were able to chat about Alexis, that situation, Manchester City versus Manchester United, Mkhitaryan coming the other way, the Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang pursuit, why that meant Olivier Giroud had to go to Chelsea, and lots more. Of course, there was power plays, dynamic shifting behind the scenes at Arsenal with Ivan Gazidis and his team heavily involved in transfers, and very publicly heavily involved in transfers as well. So look, I'm not going to do a big long intro into this one because myself and David spoke for about an hour last night, and that's what you're here for. That's the good stuff, the juicy stuff. So let's get on with it. This is myself and David Ornstein chatting transfers and the amazing January transfer window. David, hi, how are you?
Hi, Andrew. I'm very well, thank you.
You've been kept busy in this month, that's for sure.
Just a bit.
Let's go back to before this month began and maybe last December. Arsene Wenger talked a little bit about what he planned to do in the January transfer window. On the one hand, he said it would be great if the January transfer window was closed. That way it wouldn't be destabilizing. Clubs wouldn't be, you know, running around like crazy. But at the same time, he said explicitly and more than once that he wanted to do business. Now, we hear Arsene Wenger talking about, yes, I want to do business. If an opportunity presents itself, we'll be there. We want to strengthen our squad, etc., etc. But as far as you're aware, what did Arsenal have planned for January? Was the Alexis thing sort of hanging over everything?
Well, Arsene Wenger, coming into pretty much every window during his reign as Arsenal manager, has said he would like one, possibly two, I think is the exact quote. And yeah, this time he got that pretty much spot on. But if we take it back to Alexis, yeah, last summer he, of course, almost joined Manchester City on deadline day. And there was very clearly an understanding between both parties, as in Manchester City and Alexis, on that occasion, that if the opportunity arose, they would still be interested in bringing him to the Etihad in January. And so I think his mind was focused on that. I don't really buy into the suggestions that he's been useless for Arsenal, but he clearly hasn't been at the standards that Arsenal fans and the public have come to expect from him. I don't think he down tools. I don't think Alexis Sanchez can do that. But yeah, he certainly wasn't at full throttle. And I think Arsenal, to be fair, had sort of come to the acceptance, even at the end of the summer window, that he would probably go in January. You know, Arsene Wenger publicly said that he was happy to keep him, Mesut Ozil, Jack Wilshere until the end of their contracts, and that this is going to be a growing phenomenon, that players are going to become free agents, so that you get the footballing value out of them even if you can't sign them to new contracts. But I think he and they knew that they needed to try and recoup some money for him in January, with the very real prospect at that point in time of losing Ozil for free in the summer.
Were there issues with Alexis in terms of what was going on behind the scenes? Because we hear about how he was disruptive. Arsene Wenger said more than once that he was professional. He was always dedicated. He was always 100% committed. Where was the line there between his natural desire to play football and always win, which I think we've all seen in the three and a half years that he played, but also perhaps the the human element of it, the human interactions within the dressing room, where he was a difficult character at times?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because, you know, Arsene Wenger has never done anything other than defend his players in public. He's always got their backs. He's an incredible manager in that sense, incredibly loyal in a way that somebody like perhaps Jose Mourinho hasn't always been to his players. They've clearly got different ways of sort of managing their players in public. And even when Alexis Sanchez had an altercation in training last season, I think it was with Lauren Koscielny, it was a very big story. And that was factually correct, all the stories that came out. I know for a fact that that happened from a number of people who saw it and were there at the time. But Arsene Wenger flatly denied it, if you remember. Yeah. Not for the first time, being economical with the truth.
And well, the dressing room is sacrosanct, isn't it? I think that's, you know, that's an immutable law of football in a way.
And you can admire him for
that. Yeah.
But Alexis has never been one of the more popular players in the dressing room. You may have seen an interview with Francis Coquelin on Football Focus shortly after joining Valencia, saying that these stories were nonsense. They weren't. And I don't think anybody said it from a hostile point of view. I don't think they were having fights every week, but he just wasn't one of the more popular. He didn't socialize with many of the guys. He kept himself to himself with Atom and Humber, and that was Alexis. He's a winner. He expected incredibly high standards of himself and the team. And as many people have said before me, you don't need to be friends with all of your colleagues or your teammates on a football or sports team to get on well. And that was the case with him. I actually think, from my vague understanding of the last 6 months or so, that he probably was disruptive is probably the wrong word, but we'll use it on this occasion. He was probably at his least disruptive since the summer move collapsed and the January move happened. And that was perhaps symptomatic. That was perhaps more indicative of a downing of tools, so to speak. I wouldn't call it that, but perhaps he got on best with everyone because he knew he was probably off in January. And he perhaps didn't have his heart in it quite like how he did before.
Like he'd spent 3 years trying to get people to do or behave in the way that he wanted to, and realized after 3 years it wasn't going to happen. So January, he's going to go.
Yeah, and so that's why I think it was, you know, from the club's perspective, a fairly amicable departure. Notable, I'm not the first person to point this out, but it was notable that there were not that I saw anyway, any sort of farewell messages from his teammates in a way you might have expected and you've seen from other players. I was actually told by a couple of people, this isn't verified in terms of it being sort of concrete information, but I was told by a couple of people that Arsenal didn't actually make Alexis Sanchez a new contract offer. And that I'm sure they would argue in that sense that they knew exactly what he would have wanted and so didn't go and knew they couldn't go near it. And so there was no point coming to the table. But a couple of people have told me that, you know, he did love his time at Arsenal, and perhaps that was reflected in his farewell messages on social media, and that he wasn't explicitly pressing for the move. I know his representatives and Fernando Filisevic would have been doing it on his behalf, but I don't think he was causing trouble at all. In a not too dissimilar way to Olivier Giroud, he had no desire to leave. You know, Alexis, of course, wanted to further himself, but he wasn't rocking the boat to leave. Arsenal didn't offer him a new contract, and I think it suited everyone for him to leave in January, not just him.
Right. So, look, we all had the expectation that if he were going to leave, he would go to Manchester City because the interest was clearly there with them last summer. There was a bid on the table from them last summer. There's the whole Pep Guardiola connection. He's worked with him before at Barcelona. In the back of my mind, there was always this thing, though, about do Manchester City actually need Alexis Sanchez when you're 12 points 15 points clear at the top of the Premier League table. My thinking was, when it comes to the Champions League, here's a guy who's experienced and who could do that. But it became apparent after a while that their interest was cooled slightly and Manchester United's interest was very, very real. And that was something when it first happened, I thought, there's no way that could happen. There's no way that Arsenal will sell or do a deal with Manchester United. And I was thinking particularly because of the enmity between Arsene Wenger and Jose Mourinho. I felt like Arsene Wenger, of all the managers in the world who he wouldn't want to deal with, wouldn't deal with him. But when you talk about a manager doing what he thinks is the right thing for a player, I guess you kind of have to look at it from that point of view as well, where he's been able in some ways to put that to one side and do a deal with Manchester United, or at least sanction a deal with Manchester United that the club took care of. When was it clear that the United interest was really real and they were after him in a big way?
Well, it seems, and this has emerged from some of my colleagues, it wasn't my information, that Manchester United expressed a willingness to do a deal for Sanchez after the City move collapsed on the final day of the transfer window in the summer. So basically, the 1st of September, they suggested that at the next available opportunity, they would be able to do a deal for him. Since between then and pretty much that week when the deal happened, I don't think there was any significant contact. But this is a fascinating story that I'm sure we'll hear more about, all about one day when Alexis speaks in detail or writes a book, or the famous book that Arsene Wenger's promised for about 20 years one day when he retires. But so I spoke to somebody quite close to Sanchez last year who said that before the Manchester City saga even came up at the end of last summer, and I mentioned City, and that person said, no, don't think he'd want to move there. And as time went on, the Pep narrative built, despite the fact that Pep sold him from City, and Pep
from
was
Barcelona.
Complimentary about him. From Barcelona. Yeah, Pep sold him when he was at Barcelona, and the narrative built up that he was dead set for City, and you know, we'd speak to people at City, and they kind of entertained it. But don't forget that they didn't seriously come in for him until the final hours of the summer transfer window. So it wasn't like they were making a strong pursuit of him all summer, like you would if you really wanted a player. And then January comes round, and we all assumed that he was going to go to City. And I think if the numbers were right, it would have happened. But when you speak to people at City, I don't know if this is just a save face, but they said they didn't seriously come to the table in January either. So it begs the question, and that they would have been keen to do the deal next summer, the summer of 2018, which begs the question, in reality, were City ever strongly interested in bringing Alexis Sanchez to the Etihad? I had the same view as you. I didn't see that they really needed him, and I didn't think he would significantly improve him. Okay, all City fans were saying, but what if Sané gets injured? And lo and behold, he has. And, you know, they then went for Riyad Mahrez. So the suggestions that Alexis was more one for the summer, they felt they had enough attacking options. You know, Gabriel Jesus was already injured, and they were still saying that. So and Sané gets injured, and then they go for Mahrez. That sort of suggests that they wanted an attacker, but they weren't fully on board with this Sanchez deal. Meanwhile, back to your original point, Manchester United came in that week, as we all saw, and came in strong. And the deal was done. Yeah. The deal was done very quickly. And two interesting things around that. I don't know if all players say this, but in his statements, Alexis said that Manchester United was the team he had supported. Now, I know a lot of players say it was my dream to join this club or that club. Like
The Robbie Keane edict, that's what that is. Joining my boyhood club.
I think there are quotes from Henrik Mkhitaryan having said, every club that he's joined is a dream come true or something. but Alexis claimed that this was the club he supported. And in terms of your question about Arsene Wenger, well, I think we overplay this thing a little bit about selling to your rivals. Yes, Chelsea denied Arsenal Demba Ba on transfer deadline day in 2012 or something. But No, sorry, it was 2013, I think. But you know, Arsenal selling Giroud to Chelsea, a rival. Well, they were the only club who he really wanted to go to in the end. Alexis Sanchez only had one option in the end financially, Manchester United. So what were Arsenal going to do? Hold on to him and lose him in the summer and have a player who hasn't really wanted to be, you know, hasn't played with all his heart for the first 6 months of the season, doing the same for the second. The whole reason Arsene Wenger kept him was in the hope that he would play at full throttle, and he hasn't done. So they didn't have any other options. I was one of a number of people that was told that Real Madrid had expressed an interest and that Sanchez would have liked that. But I think realistically, for those numbers and the competition that he wanted to play in, which is the Premier League, Manchester United was the only option. And that's why Arsene Wenger did the deal, irrespective of Mourinho.
So when it became clear that United was the only option, what were the terms on offer to Arsenal? Was it a cash-only deal? Were they prepared to just pay a transfer fee for him? And then we get the situation where a player swap comes in, and Arsenal obviously have brought in Henrik Mkhitaryan in exchange for Alexis Sanchez. Did Arsenal, as far as you're aware, push for any other players from Manchester United? Did they suggest one or two or three? Did they have a short list of players that they would have accepted? How did it go down?
Well, you and I know that, from my perspective, at the beginning of the January window, I was working on a number of stories and wasn't really close to all of this. I didn't think it was going to be a particularly busy window. And my stance very quickly changed on that. And the information that I established fairly early on, but I didn't report it because I was on some other stories and it was contrary to what other people were saying, was that Arsenal were looking at a swap deal from pretty early on. I don't know exactly how early, but I didn't hear. When the balance shifted in publicly anyway, from Manchester City to Manchester United, there was this consensus that it was going to be a £35 million deal.
Yeah.
The first phone call I made on this story, I was told straight swap, no money involved. And just because I hadn't been particularly across it, I kind of held back on that for a bit, thinking, no, everybody's suggesting there's going to be money involved. But yeah, it seems that was the message coming to us pretty much straight away. I remember speaking to Mkhitaryan's camp, and they were suggesting that it's been made public now, Mino Raiola was suggesting that he had put this deal to Arsenal and Manchester United at the beginning of the January transfer window, which you may remember tallies with reports that he had been seen at the Arsenal training ground meeting with Dick Law. Now, we don't want to sort of pander to Mino Raiola's ego here, but we know the power of agents these days, and there would be I think there's some credence to that he put this suggestion to the two clubs. He's got great influence at Manchester United, less so of course at Arsenal. I don't think he had any players there, but as soon as you heard that meeting had taken place with Dick Law at London Colney, you're starting to think, you know what, he probably did put that on the table. And it was a swap deal from early on with no cash involved. Of course, if Mkhitaryan hadn't agreed to that move, then there's a chance Manchester United would have put some cash up. But one of my colleagues, Simon Stone at the BBC, who covers Manchester United, had been guided very heavily towards there'll be no signings at Manchester United for cash without sales first this January window. And a lot of people sort of scoffed at that when he reported it at the start. And so it proved.
Right. I mean, it's amazing, isn't it, to think that an agent is the guy who's brokering probably the biggest deal of the January transfer window, certainly the most well-publicized deal of the January transfer window. You know, it struck me perhaps that Arsenal might have been interested in someone like Anthony Martial, but if it was Mino Raiola that was driving the whole thing, then it had to be a Mino Raiola player. He wanted clearly to get Mkhitaryan out of Manchester United, and we know, of course, that Arsene Wenger was very close to bringing Henrik Mkhitaryan into Arsenal in 2016, that summer, but that deal didn't go through. because of, well, various reasons, one of which was that, you know, they decided to hold on to Alexis Sanchez. So it wasn't as if Arsenal were being foisted with a player that the manager didn't rate to some extent anyway.
Absolutely not. Yeah, Arsenal have been on the case with Mkhitaryan for years. I've heard his name mentioned in the corridors of power for quite a long time, and that 2016 move was thought at the time by some people to have been done. Arsenal thought they had him, and I think he thought he was going there, but Manchester United, it seems, came in with a bigger financial offer. We don't know all the ins and outs of these things, but there's always been sort of mutual respect there. And look, I'd be lying if I said I thought Arsenal had been planning this. We know, and we know, I'm not trying to have a dig at Arsenal.
No, I know.
Many of these clubs, things just fall into place with, you know, football, and it's understandable to an extent. But still staggering is one of the most, or the clubs are some of the most poorly planned operations in any industry. And relative to the money, it's jaw-dropping how bad the planning is and foresight at many of these organizations. But in terms of Mkhitaryan, yeah, it felt together nicely because he was a player they liked. And I think there's a lot of satisfaction that they managed to, a couple of points. Firstly, that they've managed to bring in a player who wants to be there, marginally younger than Alexis. He's got a point to prove. He is the style of player that Arsenal and Arsene Wenger like. Of course, he's not a replacement for Sanchez, but if he can recapture the form that he displayed at Dortmund and with Aubameyang at Dortmund, then Arsenal potentially got a very good deal on their hands. The second reason for satisfaction is that they managed to pull off a swap deal. And I've spoken to people high up at Arsenal who've said that, you know, January is a particularly hard window to do any business of repute, you know, any decent deals, let alone doing a swap deal, let alone on top of that, doing two swap deals. And on top of that, doing one of those two swap deals involving three players. And I was even hearing very vague unofficial whispers towards the end, and it was reported the day before, on the 30th of January, by David Woods in the Daily Star, that David Luiz's name had come up in the Giroud conversations. So that would have been a fourth... Or the third swap would have involved four players.
Ugh.
But back to your original point, Mkhitaryan, absolutely someone that Arsenal would have liked to bring in. The way it came about gave them a sense of achievement, really, that they managed to pull it off in that way. Disappointed, of course, not to get any money in for Alexis Sanchez. But don't forget, although Sanchez is a superior player on far superior form at that point in time, that Mkhitaryan's market value was probably around £30 million with, 2.5 years left on his contract.
The duration on his contract, yeah.
Yeah, and Sanchez was probably valued at about the same because of the 5 months left on his contract. And in terms of other targets, you start to get messy because you're... As you said, you're dealing with one agent here who potentially proposed that deal. As soon as you go for Martial or anybody else at the club, you're moving into different territory. But they weren't on the table. That would have had to start from scratch.
Yeah.
And I don't think any of those, especially Martial, who's been on excellent form this season for Manchester United, would have had any chance of being offered to Arsenal.
And the question then, of course, is even if you get £30 million, what can you spend £30 million on in the January transfer window? If Alexis Sanchez goes, you've got to get a body in. Arsenal have done that, and hopefully Mkhitaryan will hit the ground running. Now, that takes us to Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. Links to him emerged pretty shortly after Arsenal lost to Bournemouth, which made people cynical because of the timing of the announcement of the interest in the player. Now, had the stories come from sections of the English press, you might say, okay, you could be a little bit cynical, but it seemed to be coming from Germany. we saw an Arsenal delegation, and we saw, I think, quite deliberately, an Arsenal delegation in Germany, in Dortmund, Ivan Gazidis, Sven Mislintat, who is now the head of recruitment at Arsenal, former Borussia Dortmund scout as well, head of scouting there, and Husfami, who is the I don't know what we call him, what his official title is, contract guru, or he's the guy who's doing the contracts anyway, that we brought in from Team Sky to give the backroom team an injection of whatever it needed. They were there. They were in Dortmund. They were photographed in Dortmund. And when you see three senior executives from a football club at another football club, basically, you have to assume that they're there for a good reason, that they've been not necessarily invited, but they're there to talk. They're there to make things happen. They're there to do a deal. That was the 16th of January. And the Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang deal didn't get done until the 31st of January, maybe agreed a day or two before that. Perhaps you could set me right on that. But it seemed to me that it was done for more or less what Dortmund were looking for in the beginning. So why was there such a big delay?
Because they were dealing with Arsenal. So your original point about the Bournemouth match. Now, that defeat would not have prompted the interest to begin. No way.
No.
That interest would have been fairly long-standing within relative terms. He would have been their top target coming into the January transfer window, knowing there was a good chance of Alexis Sanchez leaving. I think at one point it emerged that Malcolm was perhaps the more realistic candidate. So when I reported that Malcolm is the top target, I didn't mean that he was their first choice target. I meant that he was the one that it looked like they could obtain.
The most likely, because
I don't think at that point it looked particularly promising for Aubameyang, who hadn't really kicked off yet, so to speak, in terms of his dressing room behaviour. Aubameyang was on the radar. By contrast, I've got no doubt that the Bournemouth match probably caused them to press the buttons, so to speak, and pursue that interest pretty urgently. And the Mislintat one's interesting because he clearly drove this deal and he had the contact. However, he's very sort of badly remembered for the way it ended at Dortmund. That I think he was banned from the training ground for a period. He fell out spectacularly with Thomas Tuchel and several others at the club, and he was persona non grata. He was told not to speak to players and officials. So you could say that that would have made the deal more difficult. But clearly, it seems that his local knowledge helped the situation. But these trips happen all the time. Ivan would have made those trips with Dick in the past. It's not extraordinary. What's extraordinary is that people don't normally get photographed when they make those trips. And it immediately put them in a tricky position, that the world knew that they wanted this player. And when you are seen flying over, you know, most people don't want to see you come back without the player in your luggage. And so that put real pressure on them. And from that moment on, Arsenal would have been trying to negotiate as hard as they could. And Dortmund would have been increasingly steadfast in their resistance and their desire to get the asking price. Mm. And frankly, it's all January is far more often a seller's market than a buyer's market. And so they knew that although they had a player who was causing an element of trouble on their hands, if Arsenal wanted the player, they would have to get up to or very close to the valuation. I know some people who have interviewed Aubameyang and worked with him, And he's not meant to be this poisonous rogue, as he's sort of been portrayed in some quarters. They suggested that he would have got over the disappointment of not moving in January and got back to playing well. And I think even in one of his interviews yesterday, he said, "I've made some mistakes, but it's never, it's never been out of, I don't know the exact words, out of spite or whatever. It's never been, it's never been nasty." And I think that was probably reflected in Dortmund's statement when he left as well, saying, you know, the last couple of weeks haven't been ideal, but we wouldn't want to let that mask what's been an incredible chapter in their history. And so I think that put Dortmund in a strong position, and it meant Arsenal, who, you know, I think things are improving on the negotiation front with the behind the scenes revamp that's been going on. But they were renowned around Europe for negotiating, and I quote people that have told me this, penny by penny, pound by pound. And that makes people
irritated.
They were known on in some certain deals to be, you know, a laugh. They got a reputation as being European football, the laughing stock of major European football clubs when it came to the negotiating table. And I've spoken to people who were just minded to walk away from the table, even on small deals, which you wouldn't even think about.
Can I just sort of cut in there, because you've mentioned a name a couple of times in the process of this interview, or during the course of this interview, which is Dick Law, a guy who, as far as everyone else is aware, had retired or had left the club back in September when his contract expired and gone back to the US because that's where his family was. That was the whole idea. But here we are, because the new director of football, the guy from Barcelona, Raul Sanlehi, doesn't start until February 1st. There was a vacuum in terms of somebody to do those negotiations. So he was brought back in?
Yeah, well, Dick Law came back in. Well, he continued on a consultancy basis as soon as the news emerged that he was going to be leaving. And he helped smooth over the transition. So he worked with Hus Fahmy at the start, who I'm trying to think of how to describe him, contract negotiator. Mm. I don't know if guru should be bestowed upon anybody in this industry, but so Dick helped the transition period, and Dick's final day was yesterday. So he the 31st of January. So he has now left Arsenal after a very long spell. His association dates back to the mid 2000s, when I think he scouted in South America, and then in 2009 he became the sort of contract and transfer negotiator. So he came back into the fold. However, he wasn't working on the Aubameyang deal. That was the delegation that you saw out there. Mm. I don't know if Raul Sanlehi was already helping out. I've got no idea. I heard some suggestions that he had been involved in some meetings in Barcelona that took place over the potential signing of Malcolm, but I can't verify them. I've just been told by a couple of people that he was doing a bit of work already. But yeah, as you said, he starts in earnest today, the 1st of February. I actually think it seems that some words came out in the German media that Arsenal had really annoyed Dortmund in this process over Aubameyang. I spoke to a couple of people who knew the situation quite well, who said that Dortmund were pretty peeved at the way Arsenal were starting out so low and making slow progress towards coming up, and some of their negotiating tactics and the way they tried to move money around and take some money off the player and move it to the club and vice versa really aggravated Dortmund. However, in Arsenal's defence, I will say that that probably happens in pretty much every deal with pretty much every club. And they won't be an exception there. It's understandable that Arsenal are trying to get the best deal for themselves. And look, if we think about what Aubameyang was valued at in the last year or so, which I saw regular reports of him being worth 90 to 100 million pounds, euros, maybe even a bit higher, that Real Madrid or Barcelona would be the club he would go to. Arsenal getting him for £56 million looks a pretty good deal for me. People will point to his age. People will point to the problems that he's had. People will point to the fact that he relies on his pace and that he's getting to the age where you may not be able to do that so much anymore. And why didn't bigger clubs and Champions League clubs come in for him if he's so good? But you only need to, you know, look at the words of German football experts and Ralf Hönigstein and those who have watched him closely to see that this is a brilliant signing for Arsenal, and I think they've got a good got him for a good price.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog.
So, okay, we've got him for a good price because the negotiation in the end worked out well, and, you know, we bargained them down pound by pound, penny by penny, and got to a point where it was acceptable for them. However, the other side of that is that we got caught up in a transfer merry-go-round. I think that those were the words that you used in one of your tweets. You mentioned a merry-go-round. Dortmund needed a replacement because they're losing their top goal scorer. They've got half a season of football to play and they need somebody to score goals, so they needed a striker. As it turned out, they looked at Michy Batshuayi from Chelsea. Chelsea, of course, then needed a striker. They'd been looking around. They'd been looking at everyone from Peter Crouch to Andy Carroll, Ashley Barnes. I don't know how true all those stories were. I like to believe they're true because it speaks to another club being more mental at transfers than Arsenal. But we're in a situation where for Batshuayi to go to Dortmund, Chelsea need a replacement. Arsenal have a replacement in Olivier Giroud. How much pressure was there on Arsenal to do that deal? Was it a case that in order for Aubameyang to happen, Giroud had to go to Chelsea?
Pretty much, yeah. So this all kicked off on Sunday evening, because I remember it interrupted the episode of McMafia that I was watching. And I do have a life outside of football transfers.
Come on, you're fooling nobody.
At that point, the plan was, and so clearly this was bubbling up over the weekend, was for Giroud to join Dortmund and Arsenal to get Aubameyang for the same fee that they ended up with. I think Giroud would have gone on loan. And I think that was the situation that all parties were moving towards. At that point, I think Arsenal were needing to convince Giroud to do it. And by that point, clearly, there were already representations to him from Chelsea. And so that's where it started to get really messy, because he perhaps understandably favoured a permanent move to another London club, which would have, you know, we know what happened with the Everton deal over the summer and his family's desire to stay in the capital. And that seemed to sort of win the day again. And it was at that point that Dortmund turned their attentions to Batshuayi, and he was clearly keen to make that move on loan as well. So all the ducks were in a row at that stage. However, Chelsea were far from impressed with Arsenal's asking price for Giroud of around £30 million. and it's at that moment that they entertained the idea of a loan swap for Fernando Llorente from Tottenham. But Tottenham, who were more than willing to entertain offers for Llorente, were only interested in losing, letting him go on a permanent basis, and they would have happily taken Batshuayi. But so the clubs differed in their approach, but also Batshuayi differed, because he didn't want to make a move from second choice at Chelsea to second choice at Tottenham. And so that's where the sort of the carousel ground to a halt and reached an impasse. And it only started to move. I'm losing track of my days now. On the 30th, when it proved clear that Arsenal weren't going to be able to get Giroud to move elsewhere, and so their negotiating stance would have softened somewhat, and a more realistic fee came into play. And I was told that it was all set to go on the 30th at £20 million. And everybody thought it was on until Marina Granovskaya, the Chelsea director and transfer negotiator, started trying to push the asking price for Giroud down.
She was Arsenaling Arsenal. Yeah,
she was. Yeah, playing them at their own game.
And, well, that's the way it goes.
Funnily enough, they didn't like that. So they now know how other clubs feel about them. And yeah, they didn't take well to that. And I was told that it was a straight, at one point anyway, a straight situation of, you pay the £20 million or we're going to pack him off to Dortmund and just do the deal with them, and then you're stuck with Batshuayi and you're cut out of the deal entirely. But then it still would have been tough for Arsenal, because there's nothing forcing Giroud, who was happy at Arsenal, he wasn't pressing for any move, he would have had to agree to a move to Dortmund. So that's when sense was seen, and the 18 or fee in the region of 17.5 million pounds was agreed, and it was done and dusted.
I mean, it strikes me that Giroud is a player that Arsenal, under different circumstances, would have kept, because he's a good striking option. There's the Europa League to play for. He provides something of a plan B. Is there perhaps a lesson to be learned from an Arsenal point of view, that maybe if you're going to negotiate, sometimes there are consequences that you can't see? That perhaps when they were trying to force Dortmund down, they never foresaw a situation where they were going to have to use a very popular player, a very effective player, as part of a deal to get the one deal that they wanted done.
Yeah, I'm sort of split on this one, because Arsenal loved him. He was very popular at the club among the players, and most of all with the manager. Arsene Wenger has always talked of his admiration and love for Giroud. But they were willing to do a deal for him to leave in the summer. You know, Everton was said to have been close. So it's not like he was such a prized asset that they had never considered him leaving before now. Now, his you know, goal scoring record was excellent, and his contributions off the bench last season spectacular. I think he's only second in Premier League history behind Jermaine Defoe for goals scored as a substitute. He really endeared himself to Arsenal fans on the whole, but you know, we all know that there were times where fans and media were very frustrated with Giroud as well. He suddenly became more of a cult hero when the Chelsea links came up.
Yeah.
And it is quite sad, you know, for Arsenal to see him go. But I don't think it's as, you know, if he hadn't been going to Chelsea, it probably would have been a bit less bad for Arsenal fans. And okay, it's always going to be tinged with sadness that a good player left. I think the more pertinent point is what you said about losing the type of player. So you may have heard Julian Laurens on the European Football Podcast on the BBC 5 Live this week said that Arsenal could have signed Aubameyang last summer instead of Lacazette, but they went for Lacazette for the lower price, who Arsene Wenger was apparently never totally convinced by. And if they'd got Aubameyang, then they probably would have had the better striker then. And then Giroud was the alternative option off the bench, and they would have never got into this position. It's a bit bizarre that they've now got Lacazette and Aubameyang and no Giroud. You've got somebody like Paul Merson saying that they should have sold Lacazette, which is a bit bizarre. But there is a school of thought within Arsenal and a few people I've spoken to who know both players really well, Lacazette and Aubameyang, from working with them in France or observing them closely in France, who are suggesting that Aubameyang's going to play in the Alexis position. And I'm not saying he's a winger, but the left channel of, you know, of the three forwards, with Lacazette in the middle, Ozil to the right, slightly, you know, of centre, and Mkhitaryan in behind, or you could interchange Mkhitaryan and Ozil. So I agree with many of the people who say it's bizarre, and Arsenal, of course, could well miss that option off the bench because they don't have a player at the football club in the mould of Giroud now, a target man who can hold the ball up and head it. You might say that Welbeck could do some of that, but clearly he's a completely different player.
Yeah.
So I think that's quite staggering that they haven't got a player at the football club who can do that. However, they can't really complain about their attacking options now.
No.
I think if you can complain about one area, it's the sort of defensive midfield and defence.
Well, that brings me on to my next question. I've got just a couple of quick questions before we finish up. Attacking options are amazing, and it's great to see exciting attacking talent at the club. And anyone who isn't thrilled by the signing of Aubameyang and the potential that he could link up with Mkhitaryan, Mesut Ozil with his new contract, is another huge boost for the club. So from an attacking point of view, you know, there are options. You know, Lacazette is there. There's Iwobi there. There's Welbeck there. Aaron Ramsey's an attacking midfield player as well. There's some young attacking talent there too. Eddie Nketiah. Not trying to get ahead of anything, but Reece Nelson as well. So there's plenty there to choose from an attacking point of view. But Arsenal fans will be concerned by the fact that midfield and defence remain untouched or remain unaddressed in this transfer window when they have been very clearly areas that have caused the team some problems. Were there, to your knowledge, any attempts to bring in players in those positions? I saw that Alan Pardew was talking today about how Arsenal basically left it too late. They put in a deadline day bid for Johnny Evans, which was rejected out of hand. And he said, look, we told them, you know, if you give us a bid on deadline day, it's got to be crazy or you can just get lost. Were there any attempts to bring in players in midfield or defence beyond that?
This is a really strange one because I think we've spoken about on the Arsecast before that that they tried to bring in a midfielder or Arsene Wenger decided late in the summer window that he would like to try and bring in a midfielder, and there wasn't enough time. And so surely, and the situation hasn't particularly improved other than the return to fitness of Jack Wilshere, but in terms of a dominating holding midfielder, which I think was the sort of thing they were looking at right at the end of the window, the summer window, that they didn't go for that now. So the situation, you could argue, in that area has deteriorated because Granit Xhaka, you will have all seen the graphic in the Times, you know, his issues with tracking back. I mean, it only goes to highlight the situation. And one of the holding midfield options has been sold in
Francis
Coquelin. So I heard nothing about a holding midfielder in this window. I could be wrong. Others may differ in their views and understanding, but I heard nothing about that. Of course, Mohamed Elneny came into sort of a little bit of form just recently. He was somebody that I was told last summer that would have been made available for transfer if there was a reasonable offer. But more recently, I've been told they're looking at giving him a new contract. So it shows how quickly things can change. But no, I didn't hear any rumours or suggestions anything about a holding midfielder. Okay. Perhaps that's a combination of Wilshere and Elneny being more prominent.
And maybe Ainsley Maitland-Niles, as somebody who has made a breakthrough into the first team, that as much as he's talked about wanting to do business, he also was very clear this month, or last month anyway, about talking about the need to give young players a chance and to develop players and for clubs to produce their own players. So perhaps there's an element of that?
Well, yeah, but there's no suggestion that Arsene Wenger wants to play Ainsley Maitland-Niles in central midfield, which people are finding quite bizarre, and with good reason. And also, it's looking, especially in attacking areas, I know Lacazette's a little bit younger, but it's very strange to see Arsenal looking such an older team these days, when you know the premise of Arsene Wenger's squad was always to be young and to try and develop from within. We used to talk about Arsenal, it feels like many years ago now, for how they were breaking records for the youngest Premier League starting 11. And it seems that's been completely abandoned now. If we are in the delivery phase, as it was coined a year or two ago, then clearly these signings are being brought in to try and, you know, pick off the trophies where they can, the League Cup final coming up, and maybe if they can progress in the Europa League. Although I was told that these signings are seen by especially the new appointments behind the scene, and, you know, Ivan Gazidis bringing in a new head of recruitment, head of football relations, head of contracts, etc. These people are seeing these new signings, Aubameyang, Mkhitaryan, as sort of being, they're laying the foundations for the start of bringing Arsenal back to being seriously competitive for major honours, Champions League, the Premier League. And that's going to take, you know, a year or two years, you know, a year and a half, you know, we don't know the exact time, but 2019 really.
Right.
I don't think, you know, you could say that's obvious, because then they're probably not going to get back into the Champions League this year, so they can't win it next year. And with City so prominent at the moment, there's a good chance that Arsenal won't get to the Premier League title next year. But I've heard 2019 mentioned quite a lot. So these players are being sort of brought together as being the start of a new push to bring Arsenal back to competitive level from sort of 2019 onwards. And if Arsene Wenger or whoever the manager is going to be can bring that blend of those experienced players, and as you say, the Maitland-Niles and Ketia Nelson, those youth players, then maybe they are onto something. Mm. But it is strange not to see, as you say, Maitland-Niles given a chance in the position we thought he would be best for. But come on, Arsene Wenger knows far better than us on where these guys are best suited for his team. And, you know, someone like Kolasinac hasn't really worked out as a signing, despite some really promising moments at the start, and so perhaps he's having to improvise by giving Maitland-Niles time at left back. In terms of the defensive areas, and back to your Johnny Evans point, they clearly wanted to bolster in defence, and that was exacerbated by the defeat at Swansea. it cast my mind back a few years ago to when they weren't looking for a striker, and I got quite a lot of stick about this at the time. They were not looking for a striker going into the final few days of the transfer window, but then they lost at Leicester on a Sunday, And suddenly there was a board meeting and they decided they would try and go for a striker because they were terrible in front of goal. And then the Falcao deal happened at Man United and Welbeck became available and they got him. And it was a similar sort of... I felt it was a similar sort of situation with the defence this time. Of course, they were aware of the ongoing problems with Koscielny's Achilles and the struggles that some of the others have had for form. But it's almost like with Arsenal, it takes a really bad result, like the 8-2 at Old Trafford, I think, in 2012, to really knock them into life in the transfer market and say, we've really got to go out and get someone.
Go on. Sorry, I mean, I'm just going to say people will say that the club is reactive in that regard, that there's not so much pro action.
That's an easy thing to say. It's quite obvious they look reactive. But I also think they would have been looking in these areas before. But it's kind of like the final straw because Wenger is very faithful to his players. He gives them as many chances as possible and he wants them to come good. He wants to give them every opportunity. And perhaps if we're going to give the club the benefit of the doubt, it's waiting for that final straw, the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak. And it's not a good way to operate, clearly, leaving things so late and not addressing problems proactively when they need to be. Johnny Evans was on the radar last summer. They certainly explored bringing him in and were trying quite hard at one point, and Debussy was offered in the opposite I understood it at the time that Mustafi was up direction. Yeah. I was told that by somebody very high up at West Brom. He was mentioned in conversations. So then he comes back into the equation on this occasion. We got some understanding that Arsenal were offering a much better package to Johnny Evans than Manchester City were. But clearly they were going to try and cut a low deal with West Brom. The reason being that all the information coming to me from Arsenal, and I'm not a Swiss Rambo, I don't know the facts and figures to a T, but the message coming was that after the Aubameyang signing, there's going to be very little money for major recruitment. And that means a large transfer fee and a large salary. And the reason why it hotted up at the end was because Giroud went for 17.5-18 million pounds. So suddenly, it's no coincidence that they did make a last minute push because they did have some money. Now, I don't know if I'm just adding two and two together, but I was guided, even though Wenger said in his press conference last week that, or he suggested, and it came out in the papers, that there was still money to spend after Aubameyang. I was always sort of being led to believe and quite firmly that there would be no significant money after the Aubameyang deal. Giroud goes, and so suddenly, with no coincidence, the Johnny Evans suggestions start up again, and that's been confirmed by Alan Pardew today. And it seems like it might have been a fairly derisory offer. I heard whispers, and it was nothing more than whispers from a couple of sources that I speak to, and there was never anything concrete. It was just suggestions that Arsenal may have been looking into the David Luiz possibility that David Woods had mentioned in the Daily Star, and also Kostas Manolas, who they go way back with, because I think they tried to sign him a couple of summers ago before Mustafi came in. And whatever the truth was to all of that, they were trying to get someone in at the last minute and it didn't happen. And that will leave a nagging sort of disappointment in the minds of Arsenal fans because, again, although it was a good window for Arsenal, they didn't finish with exactly what they needed to make them competitive this season. But you never know what they've done in attack could inspire an upturn in form.
Okay, I've got two very quick things. Just a final question just on Sven Mislintat, Ivan Gazidis, Hosfami being front and centre in terms of Arsenal doing transfers. Is that a sign that things are changing, the dynamics at Arsenal are changing, regardless of how long Arsene Wenger stays at the club? This is going to be the way that transfers are done now. These guys are the ones who are going to do the recruitment, the negotiation, the deals. Obviously, to some extent, with the I won't say the blessing of the manager, because you don't want to foist on a player, foist on a manager or a player he doesn't want. And, you know, there's no suggestion that Arsene Wenger is unhappy with Mkhitaryan or Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, nothing like that. But it is different. It is a different setup. It is more public that Arsene Wenger is not necessarily the man calling all the shots.
Yeah, yeah, that's clearly the case, that his power is being diluted. I don't think that's a secret, and that's because there are, as you say, there are people coming in who Ivan Gazidis is handing significant power to. So, and there are people who I've spoken to around Arsene Wenger who say that that's not a bad thing. You know, that was the situation with David Dean. Everybody's been baying for a David Dean type figure to come back in, many of them baying for David Dean to come back in. And that would have diluted Wenger's power. Interestingly, conversely, David Dean's departure and a sort of lack of a direct replacement gave Arsene Wenger more power than ever before at a time where he needed to have that dilution more than ever before, as the game and the transfer market was getting more difficult. He really needed the support and the structure and the sort of right hand man that Dean was, and that's what he's been lacking. So in theory, these appointments, I know it's popular to sort of create some sort of suggestion of hostility between Wenger and Mislintat after those comments about German lower league players and stuff like that, but I don't know their personal relationship. They're obviously still getting to know each other, because he didn't know Mislintat previously. Mm. But it's a support network that in theory should help Wenger. Now, I've got no doubt, and no, I don't think anyone does, that Ivan Gazidis, as the chief executive, is creating a structure for the future, and that future, logically, might not involve Arsene Wenger, whether it's this summer, the summer after, or beyond, if things go spectacularly well and he signs yet another contract. But I think they're preparing more than ever and laying the foundations for the future of the club, whether that includes Arsene Wenger or doesn't. But one thing is for absolute certain, Arsene Wenger still has the final say on everything at Arsenal. So there is no deal that is coming in or out of the club without his approval. He will stop any deal he wants to stop, and he will potentially start any deal he wants to start. These guys are growing in prominence and power, but it doesn't mean that Arsene Wenger is any less authoritative, even though sure. some of his standing is perhaps being diluted. And I don't think he would have a particular problem with that.
All right. Okay. Well, I think that sounds about right. Final thing I want to ask you is, you know, as somebody on whom people, I won't say rely, but, you know, they when you tweet, people take it as gospel, David. They hang on your every word. And particularly in this transfer window, there has been a reaction to you when you tweet things. You have generated hundreds, thousands of memes. How does it feel when you see those things every time you post something, just a litany of replies with, I have to admit, some of these pictures are absolutely hilarious?
Is it going to sound really boring to say that I'm completely sort of impervious towards it? So you sort of look and... I mean, this is going to be a really boring answer. I'm incredibly busy. I don't just report on Arsenal.
Sure.
I've got a lot of different things going on as a correspondent at the BBC. And so you sort of course, look towards the notifications to see if anybody's pointing out things that you've any mistakes you've made, or any useful comments that can add to it or whatever. And as soon as you see this sort of number of memes, you sort of have a chuckle and then get on with whatever you're doing. I certainly with a very young family of two sort of tearaway boys, I don't have time to go scrolling down there,
sure,
and sit there admiring or despairing
at the world
at what I'm seeing. I think my wife and kids are annoyed enough at the amount of time I spend on my phone and laptop and sure. in work and around the country and around the world. So sadly, I don't have time to indulge in it. And I certainly think when you start to indulge in stuff like that, you kind of probably ruin the appeal. And I think it's probably best if I just toe the BBC line and stick professional, get on with your job and let everyone have the fun they want. And it's just it's just sport at the end of the day and fun. So sometimes yeah. we take all of this too seriously and let it roll.
All right. Well, if people are having fun, well, that's a good thing. And I think that's probably a rabbit hole you don't need to go down, in fairness. Well, look, it's been brilliant as always talking to you. Thank you so much for the time and the insight. And look, we'll catch up with you. It won't be August 31st. It'll be before the start of the new season because of the changes in the transfer window rules. So sometime in mid-August. We'll catch you then for all the Arsenal penny pinching, David. Thanks a million.
It'll be a pleasure. No worries, Andrew. Take care.
Right, well, look, there you go. That was the story of Arsenal's incredible January transfer window. It's all changed from an attacking point of view. It's the same in midfield and defence. We'll just have to see how it all comes together. If it clicks, if the manager can find a way to make it work, if he can get these attacking pieces of the puzzle perhaps set up in a way that offsets some of our defensive weaknesses. But of course, those players behind those attackers have got to be the ones who give them the service and the platform to do what it is we hope they can do. Anyway, we'll wait and see what happens. It's certainly going to be interesting. My thanks, as always, to David for sitting down and giving me the time and the inside story into what's gone on at Arsenal in the transfer window. Whatever happens or whatever doesn't happen, it's always kind of interesting. You know, I think we support a football club that's a bit mad. I'm not, you know, being critical. It just is a bit mad the way it does things and the way it continues to do things and the way it will probably continue to do things. So any little bit of sense we can get out of what it is they do and how they try and do it is always very welcome. We will talk to David again, of course. Thanks to all of you for listening. Hope you enjoyed the show. Please give us a rating or a review on iTunes if you like it. That helps. 5-star reviews and ratings on iTunes. They push us up the iTunes charts, and the more people that listen to the podcast, obviously, the better. So tell your friends. If you've got Arsenal friends who've never listened to the Arscast, point them in this direction. That would be really very much appreciated as well. Anyway, we've got a game against Everton tomorrow. The return of Theo Walcott. Let's hope it's not one of those returns from a former player that we go, oh God, you knew he was going to score, for fuck's sake. I hope that's not the case. I really, really hope that's not the case. Again, thanks for listening. We'll catch you on Monday. Myself and James will have another Arscast extra then. So until then, take it easy. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.